You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Meet Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson, someone who's not a big fan of women or any of the progress that women have made in America in the last century. In fact, Reverend Peterson thinks giving women the right to vote was one of the greatest mistakes this nation has ever made. That's pretty hateful and misogynistic, but notice that no one in his congregation stood up and no one protested what they were hearing. Just listen to this clip of him speaking. This is clip number 10, Jacob. This is Jesse Lee Peterson in front of his congregation.
One of the primary reasons that it is over for America is because women are taking over. Women are taking over. They're in high, so-called powerful positions now. A few out there that are logical women can make sound decisions, but most cannot. And the unfortunate thing is that they're in powerful positions. They're running businesses and things like that. And the one thing I know for sure, without a doubt, women cannot handle power. It's not in them to handle power in the right way.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, there's always been a streak of misogyny in America, especially religious America. After all, in their view, Eve created original sin, right? My phone's going nuts. So it shouldn't surprise us that there's a pastor in America giving a sermon like this or that there's a congregation in full support of it. That kind of thing happens. But what would surprise me is if a national news organization like Fox so-called News, for example, gave Reverend Peterson a platform to spew this hateful anti-woman message. Or if Fox so-called News, say, hired Reverend Peterson, actually gave him money to be a contributor to their television programs. Now, that would surprise me. Play clip 15, Jacob.
I don't normally do this. I don't normally hijack you. But I did not know that I was going to be sitting here with Reverend Peterson tonight, who I have some very serious issues with in terms of some of the misogynist things you have said about women in your sermon about how women have created a shameless society and most women are little whores and that it was okay to call Sandra Fluck a slut, and that you shouldn't put women in powerful businesses, and if you leave women alone in the family, they destroy the family.
I don't know if you noticed or not, but the liberal Democrat women are calling themselves whores.
Liberal
they
Democrats.
Came out with a so-called group of women who are within the Democratic Party,
and
they are admitting that they're whores.
Yeah, right. All of a sudden, the women that he was condemning became liberal Democrat women. So Sean Hannity just kind of sat there and, you know, just let it go on, right? That's right. Reverend Peterson, who most Americans would call a misogynist and who I'd call a member of the Christian Taliban, is called a contributor by Fox so-called News. And notice here how Sean Hannity, the face of so-called news, refuses to condemn Reverend Peterson's hateful remarks towards women. Clip 16, Jacob.
And I'm okay with that. I just don't want to pay for it.
No.
If these women, the liberal women, want
that's
to have sex
said.
Out of wedlock, they
said.
Want
condoms. You said women are creating a shameless society, and they are destroying the family, and they shouldn't be put in powerful businesses. Address that.
I think that most people, most Americans know that liberal women are destroying the
you
family.
You said women.
They hate men. They hate society as it is.
False.
It's incredible. The reason why Hannity doesn't go after Reverend Peterson is simple. Fox is the official mouthpiece of the Republican Party, a party that's currently waging a war on women that takes many different forms. One form is supporting lawmakers who want to end women's access to contraceptives. Another form, to end preventative health programs like Planned Parenthood runs. Or jump to the defense of shock jocks like Rush Limbaugh, who call women sluts, and give airtime to a Christian Taliban pastor who thinks we should repeal the 19th Amendment. Just like homophobes and Islamophobes, Republicans have to appeal to misogynists as well to expand their party base. How else can they get Joe, afraid of women's six-pack, to vote Republican if Joe knew that the only real agenda of the Republican Party was to look out for the top 1%? Hey, he's not the 1%. He's not going to vote for them. So you throw him a bone. Hey, we don't like women. We don't like those people of color. We don't like, you know, we don't like gay people. You know, eventually you hit all the various people who are afraid of everybody. So Fox so-called News gives a platform to Christian Taliban Reverend Peterson. Sean Hannity bites his tongue. That's business as usual at GOP TV. But lost in the whole mess is how much better the United States would be if we actually gave women even more power compared to what they have now, rather than the less power that Jesse Lee Peterson is, you know, ranting about here. Clip number 11, Jacob.
How do we get to a point where women think we should pay for them to have sex? You know, how do we get to a point they want to force us to buy them birth control? These women are fighting to make us pay for that. They want to have sex out of wedlock. They want to have abortions. They want to do this and that, and they want us to pay for it.
Then here's clip 14, Jacob, Reverend Peterson preaching to the
court. One of the greatest mistakes that America made was to allow women the opportunity to vote. We should have never turned it over to women. Right now, 50% of the voting population are women. There are more women out there voting than men now because there are more women than men. And these women are voting in the wrong people.
Yeah, the wrong people. Well, when women have power, positive things actually happen. For example, in the Iroquois Confederacy, which was part of the basis of our Constitution, women enjoyed freedom and a lot of power. The result was a federation, a nation that pretty much had no war. They played week-long games of lacrosse to resolve conflicts, and that provided a very high quality of life for all its members. Ben Franklin, 1751, wrote a letter to James Parker. He said, "It would be a strange thing if six nations of ignorant savages should be capable of forming a scheme for such a union and be able to execute it in such a manner as that it has subsisted ages and appears indissoluble, and yet that a like union should be impracticable for 10 or a dozen English colonies." In other words, they did it. We could do it. What Franklin knew but didn't mention was that in the Iroquois Confederacy, in five of the six Iroquois nations, only women could vote. He and the other founders thought that must have been a mistake. They didn't realize how important it was to the Iroquois Confederacy, living for centuries in a state of peace. Iroquois women owned land. They were largely responsible for shaping the community's social, economic, and spiritual direction. And while the sachems, the tribal elders who traveled from nation to nation, were normally men, they were nominated and held to account by the women in the tribes. Compared to their colonial counterparts, Iroquois women enjoyed far more freedom and power. But America today has lost its roots and now ranks 78th in the world in female representation in government. Rwanda, which ranks first in the world, has women making up 53% of its government, and women have been instrumental in rebuilding and healing that nation, which lost a tenth of its population in just 100 days of genocide back in 94. Sweden, Finland, the Netherlands, Norway, Iceland, Denmark, Spain, Germany, Canada, the UK, the list goes on and on of nations that have more female representation in government and thus achieve better results than the United States when it comes to health care, wealth inequality, poverty reduction, and overall life satisfaction. Recent study out of the University of Oregon found that nations with more women in government even have lower carbon dioxide emissions. Another study out of the World Bank found that the higher the levels of female participation in government, the lower the levels of corruption are. So rather than trying to repeal the 19th Amendment, we should be looking into ways to give women even more power in our government. And instead of dropping bombs on backward countries where women are forced into burqas and not allowed to learn to read, we should be building schools and dropping pallets of books. Educating and politically empowering women both here in the U.S. and around the world is the key to stabilizing our population growth and producing a more egalitarian world and promoting peace. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of Jesse Lee Peterson. I know this guy is crazy, but he's on Fox, of course. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Gloria in Shannon, North Carolina. Hey, Gloria, what's up?
Yes, Tom. I this Reverend Peterson thing that you were just talking about.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a comment on that. I basically, I don't understand where the medical field is on this situation. They should come in and basically defend birth control. Because it started out, birth control started out in the, I think it was in the late 60s, early 70s.
It was 61 that the pill was legalized.
The pill, yeah. Started out then, and it was basically come about due to female problems other than birth control. And I am a witness to that. If it wasn't for that, I wouldn't even have my children. If it wasn't for birth control, I wouldn't have any children. I have four beautiful children, and it was a struggle getting them here because of my situation.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I think it's 18% of women take hormone contraceptives, not for contraception, but rather for, you know, dealing with various female problems.
That's why I had to start taking it at 13. And if it hadn't been for that, I wouldn't have been able, because I would have ended up having to have a hysterectomy before I was 20 years old.
Wow.
If it wasn't for birth control.
Yeah.
And I am so tired of hearing these people talking, slamming birth control the way for they think it's just, now that I granted there's a handful out there that take it just for controlling birth. But I did not take it for that, and I know several people that didn't take it for that.
Yeah. Well, it's,
and they need to quit slamming it.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's the ongoing war on women, Gloria. Thank you very much for the call. Virginia in Seattle. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Hi. Well, Mother's Day is coming up. I thought you'd like a little historical insight since I'm the great-great-niece of Anna Jarvis, the founder. And Anna was born of an arranged marriage between two ministers, one Methodist and one Baptist. They were circuit riding preachers in those days in the state, the Commonwealth of Virginia, which due to the Civil War became West Virginia, and the Commonwealth of Virginia still remain. And Anna's mother was a very religious, devout woman, and she bound up the wounds of any that came to her door, whether of the North or the South during the Civil War. And she went around in the community and discovered that farmers were watering down the milk and putting ground-up chalk in the milk, and she arranged to have that oversight taken care of. A number of other things. And Anna grew up seeing the good works her mother and other women did after the Civil Wars to rebuild the country. And she decided that mothers deserved more honor than they were receiving. And so she spent many years and her entire family fortune seeing to it, going around giving speeches at churches. And she had a job for a while as a secretary in Philadelphia. Her banker friend who wanted to marry her and take over her fortune, of course, managed to rob her, but she refused to marry him anyway. And hello, banker.
Now, didn't Julia Ward Howe was she wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, but she named it Mother's Day for Peace, and she wrote this beautiful poem about you know, come not to take our sons away from us for your wars, basically.
And she deserves credit for that. But it was my great great aunt that Congress finally decided was the true founder of Mother's Day.
Remarkable. Well,
Julia,
congratulations, Virginia.
People are entitled to their share of glory.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, thank you for the call, and thanks for the history lesson. I always appreciate it. Thank you, Victoria, very much. David in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey there, Mr. Tom. I was curious. Did Romney's family own American Motors Corporation whenever we bailed them out?
No, his dad was the CEO. And did we bail out AMC?
Yeah, they were in the late 70s there. They were going away. You know, their main customer was, you know, was GSA. You know, the government was buying their cars.
Right.
And they were in real trouble. We bailed them out. You know, and the deal was, remember, Iacocca was involved in that.
Yeah.
And the deal was that they weren't supposed to sell that place you know, it was supposed to stay in their hands for, you know, after that. And it was only
three or four years
after we built that they sold it.
Right. And that was Chrysler that Lee Iacocca was the CEO of. And that was after Chrysler had bought the assets of AMC. AMC used to make Ramblers.
Yeah, they
and Nashes.
And Ramblers.
Yeah, and that got absorbed by Chrysler, and then Lee Iacocca took that $1 salary for a year while Chrysler was going through whatever they were going through. I don't know if it was a bankruptcy or not. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. I just wondered if Romney was how much those guys were making out on that deal too.
Yeah, no, I think the Romneys were long gone by that time, but you know, it's because Mitt's dad George was the head of AMC. And then he became the governor of Michigan, and he was the governor of Michigan when I was a kid, so that would have been like in the 60s, which means that he must have been running AMC in the 50s, maybe the early 60s.
Oh, okay.
So that was quite some long time ago. And
yeah, I remember in the late 70s there, because I'm in my 50s now, too.
And it was the 70s
when
Leo.
They those guys out, it was because they were almost gone away when we didn't, you know, AMC was almost completely gone then.
Yeah.
You know, then they got, you know, they got that helper. Jeep wouldn't still be around today.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, the Jeep, Chrysler bought Jeep as well as buying AMC. My recollection is that they bought AMC, but I think that George was out by then. The one thing that George Romney did do that was fairly noble was there was one year that AMC did very well and they wanted to give him a very large bonus and he turned it down. He said it wouldn't be right to take that bonus. Now, it could be. I mean, there are cynics who say that he did that because he was planning on running for governor of Michigan and he wanted to be able to point to it and say, "See what I did." But there are others who say that he actually was a decent guy. And I'm inclined to think that there's probably some element of truth to the former, but a lot of truth to the latter. My recollection of George Romney as a governor is that he was a decent governor for the state of Michigan. George Romney spoke the truth. When he went to Vietnam, he came back and he said, "They tried to brainwash me." It hurt him politically. His son does not speak the truth to the best of my knowledge. Thank you, David.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we're going to check in with Congressman Peter Welch about the post office. And you've got to hear what happened in the White House.
Oh, yes. Wait a minute, Mr.
The post office has been part of America for a long, long time, and it's really part of our heritage. It's one of the few things that's actually written into our Constitution. And it's also the largest unionized employer in America, which is why Republicans decided to go after it in 2006 with a piece of poison pill legislation that has brought it down or is seriously going after it. So some good people are pushing back. Congressman Peter Welch is on the line with us from Vermont. The Democrat representing the great state of Vermont in the House of Representatives, welch.house.gov is his website. Congressman Welch, welcome back.
Good to be back, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us what's going on. You guys have some legislation you're pushing through.
Well, Sanders did a great job in the Senate on trying to save the post office. There's two issues. One is jobs, and the second is rural delivery.
Right.
And obviously, there's a recognition that we've got to make adjustments in the post office because we've got the internet, first class mail is down. But the question is whether the Postal Service is going to be committed to making those adjustments consistent with maintaining rural delivery and trying to recognize that, hey, we don't want to lose 35,000 jobs in this economy. Right. So the Senate bill that Bernie was such an advocate for is now in the House, and our goal is to put together a coalition of rural representatives, and that's Republicans and Democrats, Tom, that have got folks that need that delivery,
right,
and folks who understand that we've got to do what's required to keep these jobs. By the way, there's two things. One, what changes managerially can the post office make? You know, they've got to have some latitude to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But number two, we've put a financial a gorilla on their back by making them pay about $5 billion more into the retirement and health care plans than the actuaries say is necessary to make them financially and fiscally sound.
Right. This is the poison pill that I was referring to that got inserted in 2006 that says that over a 10-year period, the post office has to fund the health benefits of retirees 75 years from now.
That's right. And it's just not a, it's not a model that makes any sense. And it makes you wonder whether the real point is not so much the solvency of that benefit plan as it is the insolvency or the fiscal instability of the whole Postal Service.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. I mean, I realize you need to be a statesman and not go off on a crazy partisan screed, but I'll tell you, the Post Office is the second largest employer in the United States behind Walmart. Walmart is not unionized. The Post Office is the largest unionized employer in the country. That makes them a huge target for Republicans. And back, I remember back around 2005, 2006, Post Office was doing really well. In fact, they were talking about taking a significant part of their fleet and replacing their vehicles as they wore out or as they got upgraded with electric vehicles.
That's right.
And so, you know, at that point, the Republicans are looking at this going, holy cow, the Post Office is a success story. It might jumpstart electric cars in the United States. The oil industry probably got in on it. I mean, can you imagine a lobbying coalition that came together to say, we got to kill the Post Office?
You know, I'm kind of depressed to say that I think you're right, and you're telling it like it is. And the other thing that is really quite important about the Post Office, a lot of these jobs are for veterans, and veterans have a very high unemployment rate.
Right.
The biggest challenge to veterans when they get back is to get a job. They've got to deal with really difficult reentry. And in the modern warfare that we have in this country, it's not like most of us know at all what is going on with the soldiers. They come back and they go back into these communities where there aren't fellow soldiers around. They're on their own.
Yeah.
The biggest thing to get back integrated into life is to get a good job, and the Postal Service has been very, very helpful to veterans getting good jobs.
Mm-hmm. As postal employees are retiring or as people leave, then those openings become available with a priority for veterans, I'm assuming?
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's just been a great employer for the vets. But, you know, what we're seeing here in Congress, unfortunately, is really an assault on the middle class, and I put this in that category. It's the middle class jobs, but it's also middle class opportunity. You know, in a place like Vermont, our businesses really do depend on the Postal Service. They depend on overnight delivery and good service. Our Commissioner of Economic Development has made that case very, very compellingly. People in rural areas have always had the right to have an expectation that the Postal Service will work for them, too. You know, the private sector model, which is being imposed by some of my Republican colleagues on the Postal Service, ignores the reality that the private sector can offload, quote, unprofitable routes, folks who live on a dirt road like a lot of people in Vermont do.
Like I used to. You know, we lived way out in the middle of the woods out near Northfield, and I don't remember which delivery company it was, but one of them, whether it was UPS or FedEx or DHL or whatever, one of them used to, their packages, even in their package and their logo, were actually delivered by the Post Office to us.
Right. That's
so,
right.
Because they use them for last mile delivery in those places that aren't profitable to these big companies.
That's right. So, you know, we're seeing the Postal Service under attack. We're seeing the Ryan budget is going to double the interest rates that students have to pay on July 1, go from 3.4% to 6.8%, you know. And the budget has a lot of landmines for the middle class that as they get exposed, people are reacting. Like on the student loans, there's been a fierce reaction on the part of folks all around the country. And I'm seeing in the Postal Service a lot of Republicans who supported the Ryan budget, who've been on board with the rhetoric of closing it down, when they have to go home and they're talking to their rural constituents, just like when I go home and talk to folks who really depend on the Post Office, they're having second thoughts about it. So my hope is with the head of steam that Bernie in the Senate provided us in the House, we may be able to put a coalition together to save the Post Office.
Do you have any Republican coalition partners yet?
I'm working with Michael Grimm, and it's interesting. He's from Staten Island, and who'd have thunk it?
Yeah.
But he and I are circulating a letter, and then one of the things we're doing is identifying the members in the 13 states where Republican senators voted on that bill in the Senate. And,
voted in favor of Bernie's bill. Yeah,
they voted in favor. So we're gonna do one-on-ones with the congressional members in the districts of those senators, and it's a lot of Republicans. So we're trying to do this member to member, one-on-one, and make the case that hey, let's stick up for rural America, let's stick up for jobs.
Good luck on that, Congressman Peter Welch. And the way, of course, people can support that and your efforts is call their member of Congress and say, hey, we need to save the Post Office. Sign on to this thing that Congressman Welch is doing in the House.
Right.
Great.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Thank you very much, Congressman. Good luck. And I wish you the very best on this. This is a big job. Remarkable. Anna in Chicago. Hey, Anna, what's up?
Hi. Hi, Tom. You know, like a previous caller, I'm a poster child for women who took birth control at an early age for reasons other than birth control. And thankfully now I have two beautiful boys and I love being a mom. But if you take away my birth control or my adequate access to birth control, you take away my power. Like then I can't decide when and how many times I get pregnant. I can't plan a career. I can't plan other parts of my life. And because I'm losing control, then men have more control and, my life is bound to my uterus. I think it's completely a control issue.
Well, I think it is true. I really do. I think that there is a relatively small group of men. I hope it's a relatively small group of men who are all about, you know, their own neurotic insecurity and project that on women. And thus we get, you know, this crazy Jesse Lee Peterson kind of rhetoric. I mean, here's this guy coming out and just saying women never should have been given the vote and it's time to take it away from them. And Sean Hannity has him on as a paid, you know, regular guest. It's just it boggles my mind. Anna, thank you very much.
It's disgusting.
Yeah,
basically.
Agreed. Thank you very much. Great to hear from you. Renee in Taos, New Mexico. Listen on KVOT. Hey, Renee, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Fine. Hope you're well.
I got so fired up when I heard that. I don't even want to call him a pastor or a minister because he's not.
Okay.
And basically, I was just sitting here, you know, after I stewed a little bit, I thought to myself, okay, if we liberal democratic women are whores who supposedly, quote unquote, hate men, why would we want to sleep with them, right?
Yeah, you'd think.
And, yeah,
unless
you know,
it's just
right?
unless it's just to entice them into doing nasty things or something like that.
Oh, yes, aren't we just evil?
I can't get inside the bizarre logic of this. So I
can't either. And then I'm thinking to myself, okay, and if we are sleeping with men, doesn't that make the men we're sleeping with whores as well?
Well, I think in Jesse Lee Peterson's world, men are never whores. They're noble. You know, they're noble warriors. Right? They're the heads of the family and leaders of the world.
It just, you know, it's amazing. I mean, I got on birth control when I was married because I didn't want to have kids. My then husband already had teenage sons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so does that mean that I was a whore because I went on birth control when I was married?
Yeah. Well, not in my opinion, clearly.
this man needs, he's a shame to the true Christian faith, and I'm...
Well,
you know,
let's keep in mind, I believe it was his letter to the Romans or his letter to the Ephesians, Paul goes off on a screed. You know, it's right there in the Bible where he says that women should be subservient to their husbands. They should, when they enter the church, they should keep their heads down. They should have their heads covered. They should be silent. I mean, there's a biblical basis for what Reverend Peterson is saying. And it's a far more explicit biblical basis than trashing gays. Nowhere in the New Testament is being gay even mentioned. But the oppression of women is explicitly advocated by Paul in the New Testament. So, you know, Christians need to recalibrate this. You know, they really do. Renee, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. And Christian, you know, and get with the idea that, you know, times change.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, not only do times change, but maybe Paul just plain old flat out had it wrong. Well, not maybe. He did. He had it wrong. Right from the get-go. The Iroquois got it right. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And from a gray, rainy Washington, D.C. today, Scott in Linwood, Michigan. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to thank you very much for all that you've done on this program. And I just want to let you know that due to a lot of your influence, I just signed up today to become a committee or a chairperson for my precinct.
Wow. Hey, that is great. This is taking over the Democratic Party one step at a time.
Yeah, we're going to do like the Tea Party did to the Republican Party.
There you go.
Yeah, and a lot of it is due to your influence, and I watch your show all the time, and I really appreciate all the education that you've given me. And I still watch the Fox News because you got to know what the enemies are doing.
Well, be careful there, Scott. Scott, okay.
No, I don't buy into their rhetoric.
Yeah, no, I'm just joking. You're welcome to watch anything you want. Scott, thank you very much for the call. And congratulations and good on you. I wish you the very, very best. And, you know, give us a call in a year or so. Let us know how it's going, okay?
Yeah, and I would have done it sooner, but in the last 2 years, I've had both my hips and my spine operated on.
Ouch! Ouch.
Yeah, so I've been kind of in a rough way lately. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're getting out of it and you're getting into politics. It's good on you, Scott. Thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. That's remarkable. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Yeah, I had a comment about Reverend Peterson at the top of the show in the clip you played. One of the things he said was that something about paying for women to have out of wedlock sex.
Right.
And I wanted to point out it's also paying for men to have out of wedlock sex, and why aren't they?
That's true.
You know, people of adult talking about that. I mean, like if men didn't have out of wedlock sex, then women couldn't have out of wedlock sex, could they?
Well, but you know, according to these guys, Viagra is a medical treatment for a medical problem, whereas birth control is just to make whoopee, right? So,
exactly.
Yeah, there you go. It's pretty incredible. Thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you, Marco in San Mateo. Hey, Marco, what's on your mind today?
One of the things. Thank you for all you do.
Sure.
A little bit nervous here, but
that's quite all right.
One of the things that's so wonderful about birth control for women is they actually get to enjoy it without the consequences, and men get to enjoy it all the time. And that I think is important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in other words, your point is that sex should be a pleasant thing and birth control makes it possible to have sex, and what's wrong with having just pleasurable sex? Is that your point?
Yes.
Okay.
And,
I agree with
and,
you.
And women get that opportunity with birth control that they've never had in the past.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for the call. And let's see here. Sylvia in La Mesa,
yes.
Texas. Do I have that right? Hey, Sylvia, what's up?
You have. Well, I just wanted to share with you, first of all, hope that your wife is continuing good health.
She seems to be getting better.
Enjoy yourself immensely.
Thank you.
I enjoy listening to all the callers, but I wanted to let you know, I find it interesting that I always hear, no matter where I go, that the Republicans are always say, well, we need less government. We need to get government out of our lives. And yet, I live in a town of 9,000. And right off the bat, I can count 15 businesses that they're all government-related in this town.
Sure. It's about a third of our total economy. It's about 30% of our total economy is state, local, and federal spending.
Absolutely. And then if I was to go down the list of those 15 that I can name right off, they have different departments, which – again, government does create some jobs, I do believe.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, what I find amazing is that these congressmen who say government doesn't create jobs, they're drawing a government paycheck. Hello?
Well, I know. And the thing of it is that even the judges that are supposedly sitting on the bench ruling, well, they're making a paycheck. And yet they get all these per diems and so forth. But I just think I just wish sometimes I can get on TV and say, quit being so condescending, because it's not true what you're saying, and I hope that the voters really pay attention to what they're saying, because it is not true.
Yeah. Well, I think you just did it. I'm sorry. Finish your sentence, Sylvia.
Well, no, I was just saying, in my town, they're certainly doing it, and as a matter of fact, I come from an agricultural area, and the Republican wanted to put a Republican in office to build a $15 million cotton classing so that they can get their cotton graded and get their money back, and it's all government-related. I'm thinking, there we go again, another government-paid job.
Republicans don't mind government as long as it's helping make, you know, the defense contractors rich and the people, you know, the big ag people who are getting their money. You're absolutely right. Sylvia, thank you so much for the call. Jackie in Napa, California. Hey, Jackie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, thank you, and I'm glad to hear the good news about our dear Mrs. Hartman.
Yes, she is getting
now,
better.
Now, what I want to discuss is I've spent 12 years in churches in this area since I moved here because it's the only kind of society you can really enjoy. And I in-depthly, you know, studied the Word and really got into it. And as I discovered and I learned more, what I saw happening in these churches was an oppression on women that was just remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
The misinterpretation of the Scriptures, especially Paul, who is used by patriarchs all through Christendom to
sure.
oppose, to repress women, is just remarkable. And when I've presented the proper type of in-context reproduction of the, you know, reinterpretation of the Scriptures to these people, they look at me like I've come, I'm an alien.
Well, the fact of the matter is that most of the women who are in both the Old and New Testaments, and you'll find in the Quran and the Muslim scripture and,
yes.
You know, in basically the religions, I suppose probably also in the Book of Mormon. I don't know that as well. But most of the women are either, wives, concubines, servants, or prostitutes. And they're very rarely the leaders or the priests or, you know, people of power and authority. And
other than Deborah.
Right, other than Deborah. And that's very much not the situation for most Aboriginal people and Native Americans and other kinds of groups. So I think that this is an aberration, Jackie. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Excuse me. And obesity. This new study just came out indicating that obesity is set to radically explode in the United States. We have children who are being treated in utero for obesity. We have, newborns being treated for obesity. We have, it's really quite startling. They're looking at, 30-40% of Americans, maybe more, who within the next 10 or 15 years, 20 years, will be obese. And right now we're pushing the neighborhood of a third of Americans. And obesity is really misunderstood. People, historically, the rap on overweight people has been that they're lacking self-control or some kind of thing like that. And for a while there was the, oh, my hormones are out of balance response. But increasingly it's coming to be understood as a form of malnutrition. So at least much of it, not all of it, obviously, but what we're seeing in the United States and in much of the developed world that is just over the last 30 or 40 years experiencing this epidemic of obesity, and it's really picking up. It's been really picking up steam since the mid-70s or to the mid-80s when, I believe it was the mid-80s, when high fructose corn syrup became widely available and pretty much all the soft drinks replaced cane sugar with corn syrup and things like that. And 5 years later, we're seeing this after that, the obesity starts. So there's a concept about this that I think is pretty important, and that is that most drugs are not dangerous in their natural form. They become dangerous when they become concentrated. Excuse me. Coca leaves, for example. I was down in South America hanging out in a very rural Aboriginal area, and the people who live there chew coca leaves. In Peru, and said, here, and try this. And I'm chewing a coca leaf with a little bit of lime to dissolve the alkaloids out of it. And it was like drinking a strong cup of coffee. I mean, it wasn't even actually that strong. But if you take the coca leaf and you distill the cocaine out of it, now you've got a problem. Now you've got a serious, dangerous, addictive drug. Similarly, opium poppies, all, you know, all over the world, there are places where they naturally grow opium. People make tea out of it. Not a big deal. But if you refine it and distill it and turn it into morphine and then turn the morphine into, I think it's dihydromorphine, also known as heroin, it will kick your butt. I mean, it will seriously addict you and change the nature of your life and change the nature of your body's biochemistry and your internal, you know, everything from your immune system to your neurology. Foods in their natural state, I would submit to you, are good for us. You know, particularly fruits and vegetables. Grains too, probably. If you're just chewing on, you know, grains, maybe, you know, a little boiled rice, that kind of thing. But when you refine these foods, when you take, you know, 1,000 pounds of corn and you boil it down and subject to a chemical process and turn it into something, high fructose corn syrup, something that you'd never find in nature. You could walk through the forests of the fields forever and you'd never find high fructose corn syrup. That concentrate has, essentially it becomes a drug. And it's not just true of corn syrup and corn. I mean, you know, from high fructose corn syrup to highly processed breads and meats, you know, and people eating just the muscle meat when instead of the entire animal that they used to eat, for those people who eat meats, I'm not one of them, but I understand some people do, to vegetables. Vegetables, you know, if you buy vegetables that, you know, in a TV dinner. I mean, I remember as a little kid when TV dinners were just becoming popular. And my parents, my mom and dad, thought they were so, you know, ahead of the curve that they bought these TV dinner trays. And we literally used to, and this was like, you know, Louise's parents, her family was completely different. They were just horrified by this trend. And her mother always made sure that they had, you know, good meals that she made from scratch every night. My parents, God bless them, thought that this trend of, hey, let's get these TV dinners and stick them in the oven. This is before microwave. Stick them in the oven, heat them up, and here's all the different food groups and all the, and it's all, you know, scientifically balanced and good for you. And so we'd sit in front of the TV with these TV trays, these TV tables in front of us and eat our TV dinners while we were watching, you know, Walter Cronkite and the evening news kind of stuff as a little kid. And a lot of that food was so processed. I mean, what processing does, you know, if you're a company that's making TV dinners or you're a company that's making processed foods, you know, here's your pre-done enchilada or your pre-done whatever it may be, fish sticks, for example, you know, they can take the grodiest piece of fish and turn it into a fish stick because you can't see it, right? It's breaded and fried. They can take the worst falling apart, disintegrating, wrecked vegetables and fruits and turn them into salsa or whatever, and you never know. They put the pink slime into the burgers. It's all about money. I mean, it's very expensive to pick fresh fruit and vegetables out there in the field and then carefully get them intact from the plant to you. It's expensive. It's time consuming. It's a whole lot easier to get a whole bunch of it by machine, and so what if it gets wrecked in the process and mangled and mutilated and a little funky and a little fuzzy? So what? It's a lot easier to pull it together and organize it that way and then, you know, process it and, you know, add a lot of sauce to it so nobody can see where it came from. So the bottom line is that our food has become a drug. It's like, you know, as heroin is to opium, processed food is to real food. And you end up with people living in food deserts. Food deserts are places where you can't get fresh food. Everything, you walk into the store, everything is processed. And the result of these food deserts, and the result of people buying into the TV dinner thing, and the result of the people buying into the, and increasingly eating in restaurants, this is, we had a guest on the other day who was talking about restaurant workers and pointed out that restaurants are now employing more people than pretty much any other industry. I mean, it's a huge, We've figured out a way to have an economy that works. We feed each other. But what we're feeding each other with, I mean, the restaurants, you say, yeah, I'll have a bowl of soup. Little did you know that that soup came in a giant box with a plastic bag lining it. And the plastic is probably full of weird plasticizing chemicals that are hormone mimickers that, you know, will cause hormone-mediated cancers. But in any case, it's concentrated. It's a concentrate. And so it produces things like diabetes and heart disease and all this other stuff, not to mention the cancers that can come from the food additives and the processes that they use to make these processed foods. So next time you drive by a fast food place, just think in your mind, just imagine you're actually driving by a crack house selling drugs, because it essentially is. We need to make fresh and simple foods available to low-income people and do something to reduce the American consumption of drugs like corn syrup and French fries. I mean, how many times in your home have you made French fries? Just think of all the work that goes into it. Preparing the potatoes, boiling the oil, finding the oil, boiling the oil. It's just something people normally wouldn't do that. If we're just feeding ourselves, we don't do things like French fries. But people are eating French fries every day now because they're going to these fast food restaurants. And we wonder why this country is suffering from an obesity problem, which is turning into a public health disaster.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you combine that with the spread in wealth, which also leads to obesity, and you've got a double whammy. Been you with the water cooler wars. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Mary in Chicago. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hi. I partially disagree with you about the obesity.
Okay. Go for it.
You know, when I was growing up, there wasn't obesity. If there was, it was extremely small.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, I don't live in a food desert, and yet there are lots of obese people around me.
I would submit to you that many of their refrigerators are food deserts. They're filled with processed foods.
It's not somebody else's fault.
Pardon?
Sorry. That's their fault, isn't it?
Well, I'm not really sure. You can build a... Go ahead and say your piece.
How can you build a case for that? You know, people have to be responsible for what they put in their mouth and for how they exercise. I am one of the fortunate few. I can eat everything and anything and never put on a pound. But that's also because I ride horses.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not spring chicken.
Yeah. No, I got that. And I think that there is, and Mary, your phone is just going nuts. Thank you very much for the call. There is an important point about, you know, individual responsibility. And that's the point that the Republicans, that's their mantra. You know, oh, it's all your fault. You know, whoever you may be. And if somebody's overweight, it's their fault. I don't think it's quite that simple. I really genuinely don't. What we know now is that when people eat high fructose corn syrup, and it's in foods you wouldn't not, you know, it's in ketchup, right? You think of ketchup? It's in breads, in some breads, actually. I mean, it's in most beverages. When you eat high fructose corn syrup, it actually alters the way your metabolism works. We have chemicals in our food supply that human beings in our millions of years of evolution, our 165,000 years on this planet in our current form, have never seen before. Our bodies are not prepared for them. And this is why I'm making the comparison to heroin. Because heroin, when you use a little bit of heroin, you know, the first couple times it's like, oh, hey, this is fun and this, you know, after 4, 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 doses, I don't know what it takes, but after a certain threshold, well, it's the same thing with nicotine. I mean, I can speak from personal experience there as well. I mean, you know, it's just, I smoked cigarettes for 5, 6 years. And, you know, the first couple, yuck. And then, oh, this isn't so bad. And then, oh, my God, I've got to have one. And it becomes an addiction. And I am convinced that our corporate food system in the name of profits, has replaced what used to be a food supply that was mostly made up out of fresh foods. I use the example of you go into a store and buy some soup. 40, 50, 60 years ago, you walked into a, or into a restaurant. If you walked into a restaurant 60 years ago and said, I'd like a bowl of soup, that soup was vegetables in the refrigerator 3 hours earlier. Now, if you go into a store, into a restaurant, and you say, I'd like a bowl of soup, odds are that what you're getting was shipped into that restaurant in a giant plastic bag inside a box with a valve on the front of it. And it was made a thousand miles away. And it's got dozens of chemicals in it. And in, including high fructose corn syrup and other things that, that are going to alter your metabolism in ways that you're not expecting. And people get started on these things very often, very young. In fact, very often they get started on these things in school lunch programs, particularly where they've been privatized by the Republicans, and you get these corporations coming in and providing the school lunch programs. They're taking the federal dollars, and they're saying, what's the cheapest way we can deliver food to these kids? Oh, well, let's give them the most processed foods. Those foods are heroin. They're addictive. They cause metabolic changes that cause people to crave more of them. And then the people just think, hey, you know, it's, I'm hungry. I need to be eating this. And the result is that you got a, you've got an epidemic of obesity. Lee in Reed Point, is that Montana, Lee?
Yes, sir.
Hey, you're on the air. What's up?
How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true
good
for you.
What I called about is, it's been one of my pet peeves for years is sugar, refined sugar. Yeah. And the way I found out about it is years ago I had a girlfriend, and she told me about a book called Sugar Blues.
William Dufty. I knew William Dufty. Who wrote that book? Yeah, Gloria Swanson was on the board of the Children's Village that Louise and I started, and the actress, and she'd been a vegetarian since the 1920s, and William Dufty was a good friend of hers, and he helped partially ghostwrite her autobiography, and I used to go up to New York, and we'd have dinner together at her apartment, and William Dufty was often there. He was a great guy, and he was so spot on with Sugar Blues. And basically the book, for those people who don't know what we're talking about, this brilliant book that came out in the 70s or 80s, it must have been the, whenever it was around that time. And it was
78.
Yeah, okay.
79.
Yeah, and the essence of the book was that sugar is a drug, and it's an addictive drug.
Oh, it was
at least for many people.
Book. He went into the studies how they fed sugar cane to hogs and they got fat.
Yep.
And then they processed the sugar cane down into a mash and stuff, and then fed it to the hogs and it killed them.
Yeah, and if you
and
think
they
that
opened them up and they were bleeding inside.
Right, and when he wrote that book, that was before the high fructose corn syrup had come along. I mean, back then it was cane sugar, and he was talking about how, you know, this stuff is a drug. And again, cane sugar is something that really has only been a part of the human diet for 100 or 200 years. And now we've got this, you know, if you think sugar is bad, high fructose corn syrup is sugar on steroids. And it's even worse. And it's being subsidized with our tax dollars. Lee, thank you for the call. We are subsidizing Big Ag to produce the kind of corn that will produce high fructose corn syrup so that we can poison and addict ourselves to foods that make us obese. This is not right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I, you know, somebody's got to come out and say it, because if we continue down this road of just saying, oh, well, you're fat, that's your problem, we're going to have a big blow.
And I pull out some Fritos corn chips, Dr. Pepper, and an old moon pie. Then I sit back in glorious expectation of a genuine junk food high. In the daytime, I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. Oh, but at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me. All right.
Welcome back to the True People's Media. See, this, you say, well, you know, what does obesity have to do with politics? I think it's totally about politics. And it's not just politics. It's because politics is what has allowed the corporate takeover of the American food supply. It was Ronald Reagan in 1982 who stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act so that in 1983 you saw this mergers and acquisition mania, the whole Michael Milken thing, the M&A artists, all this stuff. And all of a sudden, all these small companies started becoming giant companies. And that's why when you walk into your local store or your local restaurant, because there aren't local restaurants anymore, they're all chain restaurants, right? When you walk into your local restaurant and you say, I'll have a bowl of soup or I'll have that, whatever, you know, fill in the blank. It wasn't made there fresh that day. Or when you go to a store and you buy something, it was shipped from thousands of miles away. And it was processed at a giant factory. And the small local process, it's just gone. We're eating chemistry. We're not eating food. And people wonder why our metabolism is changing. And frankly, I think it's been changing in a whole variety of ways. It's just that being fat is one of the obvious ones. But we're also seeing an epidemic of cardiovascular disease. We're seeing an epidemic of high blood pressure. We're seeing an epidemic of autism. Children being born with some of these problems. We're seeing an epidemic type 2 diabetes, which didn't even used to be diagnosed in children. It used to be called adult onset diabetes. They no longer call it that because so many kids have it. Had Reagan continued to enforce the Sherman Act and prevented any of these giant corporations from becoming so large that they could dominate entire industries and sectors and wipe out their small competitors, we would still have local food, in my humble opinion. This is the wreckage of the libertarian slash Republican worldview. Carrie in San Francisco. Hey, Carrie, what's up?
Hi, thank you. I agree with what you said. And I also want to add to the conversation that doctors don't diagnose you until you've lost 80% of your pancreas. So if they're not even aware of what is diabetes going on with the person, and it is such an expensive disease because you have to monitor at home. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to save money by not providing the supplies that you need,
right.
or you know, finding out how is this and are they checking this?
Yeah,
you should have an HbA1c, which is a blood test, below 5.7%, below, so that your eyes aren't affected because you go blind.
Right.
It starts at your feet, so that's another area. Yep. When you have painful feet.
Right, you get gangrene. But it's even
your feet all day. It's because you probably have a diabetes HbA1c much yep. higher than 5.7.
No,
the doctors think that you're okay at 7%. That is so high. That is so high.
Yeah. No, I got it, Carrie. Thank you very much. Excellent point. Personal experience. If I eat sugar before I go to bed, I get leg cramps. I mean, it's what I've discovered is, you know, okay, I'll take some apple cider vinegar and it makes them go away. But if I don't eat the sugar, they don't come on. I think that that's associated with all, I mean, my dad, by the time he was my age, had diabetes. I don't, thank God. David in Chicago. Hey, David, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I was actually listening a little bit earlier when you were talking about the whole sugar thing and the obesity epidemic. And I have a couple points to make. First off, as for the addictiveness of sugar, high fructose corn syrup is just that. It's a syrup that has a lot of fructose in it, which is a very basic type of sugar.
Right.
The only addictiveness in high fructose corn syrup is the same as it is with any other sugar, and that is that we human beings are pre-wired to crave things like salts, fats, and sugars as a survival mechanism.
Because they were so rare.
Yes, there's an overabundance of sugars right now, which some people then overeat and become obese.
Right.
And I think you actually made a very excellent point when you were talking about comparing obesity to heroin addiction. That is that both of them have tremendous amounts of resources in our country and around the world that tell people these are dangerous, addictive substances. You should not use them, and you should, in the case of sugar, not abuse them. And people choose to engage in this anyways, for the most part.
But my point is that I don't think that most people are choosing it. I don't think that most people realize the consequences of the processed food that they're eating until they're 30, 40, 50 pounds overweight, and then they're sliding down that path.
I don't think that's a fair argument, because there's resources available everywhere about this. There's commercials, there's PSA on TV.
How many people smoke in America?
Quite a few, and they're all aware of the fact that it's
like one in six Americans, I think. And yes, people know that there's a problem with that, but they're addicted, and it's not because they're bad people. It's not because they're lacking willpower. It's not because they've just chosen to become a tobacco addict. Addiction is a serious problem, and I'm telling you, and I think, frankly, let me come back to this heroin metaphor again and point out to you that there is an entire industry, or cocaine is probably a better example, that I can speak from personal experience with. Having chewed on coca leaf and having also tried cocaine as a kid, that that it's a world of difference, and the natural substance is not as dangerous or deadly as the drug itself, and not as addictive. And we have built a very profitable infrastructure around cocaine in the United States. It's the prison, the for-profit prison industry, and the drug testing industry. These are multi-billion-dollar industries, and they're built around the idea that people have to be abusing drugs for these industries to exist. And I would submit to you, and we could solve that problem tomorrow by turning all of the drugs from a criminal problem into a medical problem, as Portugal did. Broke the back of organized crime, saw a decrease in HIV rates, saw a decrease in drug use when they simply decriminalized all drugs. We could do that. But it would put out of business the drug testing industry, which is a huge industry. I mean, this is how Rick Scott makes a lot of his money. So it put out of business the drug testing industry. It would put out of business the private prison industry. Half of the prisoners in America you'd have to let go tomorrow. And particularly in poor communities, which is, you know, very often minority communities, where if you want to be an entrepreneur, what are you going to buy and sell? How about some pot? How about some coke? How about some heroin? And boom, you end up in prison. And then you get the Republicans saying, oh, and by the way, anybody who's been to prison, they can't vote. Right? I mean, it's not just an industry. It is, anyhow, Chris in Albuquerque. Hey, Chris, thanks for listening to KABQ. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Fantastic show, by the way.
Thank you.
Love you. I was calling. I'm an organic farmer in New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and there's been major inflation on organic vegetables and beef, well, any meat that you can buy. And the one thing I wanted to mention, especially for poor families, like they can actually choose between the dollar meal at Wendy's or they can go to the co-op and spend $7 on a pound of, you know, broccoli and lettuce.
High quality food. Yeah, that's my point. It's a whole lot cheaper now in America to eat addictive food. And for people who really have no choice, I mean, who are, you know,
they've lost their jobs.
Yeah. Food stamps is $3 a day. I mean, how can you eat on $3 a day?
And you can. And, like, one thing that we've been trying to set up, especially through just the community, I'm up in Cedar Crest farming, so we do trades with people
mm-hmm.
to get good food, especially the families that have lost their jobs.
Right.
But I think that's probably an epidemic across the country at this point. And, yeah, the inflation on actual food is insane at
yeah,
this point. Yeah,
especially healthy food. Healthy food is, you know, more and more in demand, and it's becoming more and more of a boutique product, while at the same time, crappy food, basically, you know, fast food, is becoming the mass market product. And as you know, the 80% of the people consume the mass market product, and 20% of the people are consuming the boutique product, and we're moving in the direction of everybody consuming this stuff that is causing obesity, in my opinion. Chris, thank you very much for the call. Well said. Deborah in Johnson City, Tennessee. Hey, Deborah, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I want to thank you for your show. I had just a thought. One thought, and then I wanted to ask you for your thought on something
else. We have
else.
Just a minute, so it's, I mean, literally
okay,
just one minute.
Okay, the first one is, if you're confused about being a woman in the Bible, go to the very last chapter of Proverbs, and you'll be proud to be a woman.
Okay. I'll have to check that out.
Now, and I want to hear your comments on Bandana Sheba on GMO, Seeds of Change.
Oh, yeah.
It gives a great description of how they shoot the seeds' DNA and get the food unfit to put in the human body before the fructose is even added.
Yeah, no, okay, they add the genes from fish to them. You know, I mean, it's a
Okay, I'm going to hang up and listen to you.
Okay. Yeah, Vandana Shiva is absolutely brilliant. I moderated a roundtable conversation that she was part of the weekend before last for 2 hours. And, boy, is she a pistol. In fact, I talked to Sean afterwards. I said, we've got to get some of these people on this program, and Vandana Shiva was one of them. And she has written so eloquently about this topic, and particularly how it's devastating her country of India. And you have these farmers all over India that are literally committing suicide because of the havoc that has been wreaked by these giant multinational seed companies. So, yes, you're absolutely right. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check into the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in the world, and continue to take your calls and move along with this topic and more. It's Talk Media for the Sane Among Us, the Tom Hartman Program, and Kate in Silverton, Oregon. Hey, Kate, what's up?
Hi. Thank you so much for bringing up this topic. Every time I listen to you, Tom, I learn so much. I want to say that I am a nurse practitioner, mm-hmm. and I talk with young women all day, every single day about this issue. And one of the incredible things is that young women today don't know how to cook. When I tell them go to the supermarket and shop the outside of the supermarket, up the fruits and vegetables, across the meat and poultry, and down the dairy, and only go in the center if you need cleaning supplies, the common response is, then what would I eat? And
wow.
It goes even deeper than that, Tom, because today, you know, so many young girls aren't getting married. And not that I want them particularly to get married when they shouldn't, but society has wedding showers and wedding gifts for people. And young girls today don't have pots and pans. They don't know how to cook,
Neither do men. Neither do men. I mean, you know, home ec, when I was a kid, right. Home ec was something the girls took. But frankly, there are a lot of men who were very proud of the fact that they could cook quite well, thank you very much. And we need to bring that back as well. Kate, thank you very much. Excellent point. Helen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Talk Radio News brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, Ellen's project to save lives in Sudan, in South Sudan. Ellen, welcome back. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. Sorry I'm a bit late. My car was stolen today, so I wasn't in such
Your
a great
car
way.
Was stolen?
Yes, I parked in the garage here at this apartment building, and it's gone, and I've been with the D.C. cops. My stupid mistake is that I have left my key at the front desk, and Southeast is very easy to get into my apartment, and that's where I keep the key and whatever. Whatever. Anyhow,
my.
No more car.
Yeah.
So,
well, maybe it's liberating, Ellen.
Maybe I'll walk a little more. In any case, so I think the big news of the day is that the Senate voted 52-45 to essentially filibuster the student loan bill. And it is interesting, the one present is the woman who is so angry at the Senate in terms of the way business is done, and that's Olympia Snow in Maine.
Did she vote? She did not vote for the filibuster?
She voted present.
She voted present. Ah,
other
so
than
she...
that, it was totally along party lines, basically.
Wow.
And
now, just let me set this up, if I may. Correct me if I'm wrong, because many of our listeners may not know what you're talking about. Student loans on July 1st are going to double the interest rate, and unless Congress acts, these are federally funded student loans, or federally backed.
That's right.
Right. Federally backed student loans, and that interest rate is going to double. And if we're going to continue with them not doubling, keeping them in the range of 3.5% instead of 6.5% or 7%, then what we have to do is we have to pay for it. The Democrats said, let's pay for it by closing a loophole that's mostly used by the oil industry, and although many big businesses use this tax loophole. And the Republicans said, let's pay for it by throwing people off, by closing programs that do mammograms and preventative health care for women in particular, and by making it harder for people to get food stamps and making it and cutting eligibility for unemployment, if I recall
basically,
correctly.
The Democrats wanted to change some of the way Social Security and Medicare taxes basically they're classifying their pay as dividend, not cash income. I mean, that's sort of one piece of it.
Right.
And then the Republicans wanted to change the health care law, particularly on preventative health care.
Right. So, oh, that's interesting. So the tax loophole was about not, you know, paying the Romney tax levels on dividends rather than regular income.
That's correct.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I didn't know that. So in any case, the Republicans prevailed in the Senate because they filibustered, even though they didn't have a majority. They only had 47 votes, would it be?
Well, basically, you need 60 votes to get something to the floor, essentially, to a vote.
Right.
So it was 52-45 on the procedure, which is essentially, because once it passes that procedural 60 votes, then it's a simple majority.
Right. Right.
And it would have passed, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It did with 52 votes. I mean, there's 100 people in the Senate. 52
That's
is a
right.
nice, healthy
but
majority.
There was that 60 vote.
Right. So, you know, this is, again, so in other words, Mitch McConnell or some Republican decided to filibuster this thing. Is there never going to be a political price to pay for filibusters? It used to be a very expensive thing. You burned political capital by engaging in filibuster.
Well, and you had to burn the midnight oil as well, and now
yeah.
you don't. Now you just simply say, we're not going to vote, and that's the end of it. And one member of the Senate can change things. And, you know, I remember, I think, was it either Frank Plone, one of the representatives from New Jersey said, you know, this is exactly what happened in Poland before it was partitioned, because nobody could ever agree. And one person could stop a vote. Well,
right.
that's the same way here.
Yeah, that's definitely what's happening in the U.S. Senate. And will continue to happen until or unless there's 60 Democrats or 60. Well, actually, the Democrats don't do it to the Republicans like this. So it would take 60 Democrats or 50 Republicans, I guess.
That's right.
Amazing.
So,
what else is going on?
Well, of course, you know, today is also, I'm sure you've been talking about it, some of the recall votes that have been going on. And the major recall vote is happening in Wisconsin today.
Yep.
So people are eyes on that. Of course, there's the gay amendment in North Carolina. And that is going on. And then, of course, the Lugar, he's probably going to be run out of town by the Tea Party. So that is happening today, and we really can't forget that. The president is also basically, he's giving the Congress a to-do list. He says we can't wait until November to get things done. He was at a nanotechnology facility at the University of New York in Albany, State University, SUNY Albany. He said, I know that's an election year, but it's not an excuse for inaction.
Yeah, that's...
And as you know, this is not a big surprise. Mr. Santorum endorsed Mr. Romney.
So is Romney paying off his campaign debts the way he will?
Well, we don't know that, but if I'm a guessing person, he's paying off the campaign debts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the price for the endorsement. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoodsForTheOldGoat.com. Check it out. Ellen, thank you.
Thank you.
Great talking with you today. We will be back. We will be back, actually, with Steve Busey, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. It's going to be entertaining.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, Steve, how do you... Bucci. My apologies,
yeah.
Steve.
No problem.
Welcome to the program. Steve Bucci, PhD, Senior Research Fellow, Defense and Homeland Security with the Heritage Foundation. Heritage.org is the website. Steve, the CISPA bill. This thing is giving a whole lot of us a lot of pause. And I don't understand why an organization and a group that historically has fought against big government would embrace CISPA. This, for people who don't know what CISPA is, it's the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. It's the ultimate Big Brother bill, is it not?
No, it's really not, Tom. The CISPA is, as written, is actually a fairly reasonable way for us to improve cybersecurity, particularly voluntary information sharing between the federal government and various private entities without violating individual liberties or giving the bad guys an advantage in this fight.
But it completely exempts itself from the Freedom of Information Act, for example. I mean, there's no oversight. There's no protections on this thing. It supersedes all other provisions of laws protecting privacy, including the Fourth Amendment.
How can
you tell me this is a good thing?
Well, it's a little bit of an overstatement to say that it obviates the Fourth Amendment and
where
no
in CISPA does it require test it? Where does it require a person to swear an oath that you have probably committed a crime before they can snoop on your internet activities? Where is it?
What they're going to be doing is sharing threat information, which is predominantly technical information. Not, you know, they're not going to be passing your emails along.
How do you know?
Because that's not what the information sharing provisions provide for.
There is nothing in there that prohibits it.
But there's no reason for them to share it.
But there's nothing in there that prohibits it. If you're giving this, I'm making the Heritage Foundation argument. You give these kinds of power to government, it's going to use them.
Well, they're not giving that kind of power to government. What the majority of the information that's going to be passed, frankly, is going to be from the federal government to private entities, letting them know the type of threat profiles that are out there, the types of malware that are being used.
And those private entities then have blanket immunity from any future lawsuits? How is this a good thing?
No, they don't have blanket immunity. They have immunity as long as they have acted in good faith, meaning that if they pass information back to the federal government, that they have done so specifically to let people know the kind of cyber attacks that they have undergone, and that's the information they pass. They're not going to be passing wholesale piles of data from their employees or anything like that.
Well, let me read this. This is, you know, one of the most egregious aspects of CISPA is that it gives blanket legal immunity to any company that shares its customers' private information. In other words, if Microsoft were to share your browsing history with the government, despite your posing no security threat, you would be barred from filing a lawsuit against them. Without any legal recourse for citizens to take against corporate bad behavior, companies will be far more inclined to share private information.
Well, whoever wrote that, I would respectfully disagree with them. That is a misinterpretation.
The attorneys at the Center for American Progress wrote that.
Well, that may be, but they're misinformed. And they're erroneous in this point.
Citizens have to trust that companies like Facebook aren't going to share our personal information? These guys make money sharing our information. That's their business model.
And they do. They do it commercially on a pretty regular basis. But the federal government has no particular interest in that. They're looking for information on cyber intrusions, malware profiles.
They already have the ability to do that. The federal government already has the power to do that.
They have the ability to collect it on their own networks. They don't have the ability to collect it on private sector entities.
Certainly they can. What are those courts called? The
FISA court.
The FISA court. Thank you very much. They can go before the FISA. In fact, they don't even have to go before the FISA court. They've got 3 days that they can snoop on you before they even have to ask permission to snoop on you. I mean, this has been the case for a long, long time.
But that's not what they're doing. They're looking for information. I mean, the federal government does not know when Company X has experienced the cyber intrusion. They don't have sensors on every single company or even the majority of companies in the United States. They just don't have the ability to do that, nor the particular desire to do it.
But you don't think that if a company thinks that it's under attack from a foreign power, that it's going to call the FBI and say, hey, we've got a problem?
Yes, and they should.
They don't need CISPA to do that.
The federal government is there to protect them.
They don't need CISPA to do that. This is big government run amok. I don't understand why this got partisan. Why most Democrats are opposed to this and most Republicans are supporting it, other than that there are very large corporations who, you know, with this information can make more money, and certainly with the government revenues, you know, it's basically now if you're in the computer business, you too could be part of the military-industrial complex and make even more money. And, you know, they're lobbying very aggressively and giving a lot of money and campaign contributions to Republican politicians. But it seems like it's the opposite of the message that I have historically heard from small government Republicans.
Well, the problem, Tom, is that right now we are facing a large degree of cyber espionage that's going on. It's an unprecedented level. The technology allows bad guys to come in and get information from our government entities or from unprotected civilian entities.
But giving lawsuit immunity
is hurting this country.
But giving lawsuit immunity to private corporations that are going to take our information and share it with each other for profit is not going to help save us from the Chinese. I mean, we're very much now at one of those Ben Franklin moments, you know, where those who would sacrifice a little temporary security, who would gain a little temporary security in exchange for their freedom deserve neither. I mean, this is, go ahead.
Well, again, Tom, that's not what's going on here. Right now, as the CISPA has passed, after the amendments that were made when it got to the House floor, there is a specific provision that says that there is liability if the company has passed that information in bad faith. If they're passing that information, it's either the wrong kind of information.
But that's going to take a whistleblower. I mean, those kind of things.
All it takes is someone filing a lawsuit and saying they did it in bad faith.
But then you have to demonstrate it. And to demonstrate it, you're going to have discovery, and you're going to have to get information that they're saying, oh, I'm sorry, that's classified.
Well, I don't think
good luck on
that. There's
also a provision in CISPA, and this is, you know, quoting from CISPA. It says, as the bill is currently written, CISPA would apply, quote, notwithstanding any other provision of law, end quote. This is right from the law. In other words, you know, privacy restrictions in place don't apply to CISPA.
Well, actually, that line is there so as to not push it past other provisions of law. It does not supersede already existing protections that are out.
Ars Technica noted, and I'm quoting them, if a company decides that your private emails, your browsing history, your healthcare records, or any other information would be helpful in dealing with a cyber threat, the company can ignore laws that would otherwise limit its disclosure. Isn't there something wrong with that?
I don't think that's the correct interpretation. There's absolutely no reason in any way,
then
shape, or form.
Why is the president threatening to veto this?
That you'd have to ask the president. I'm not sure why he's threatening to veto it.
You don't know why the president of the United States would want to veto this bill, and yet you're going to advocate for it? You haven't evaluated the arguments against it?
I have evaluated the arguments, and the president's position is primarily a partisan one, and I think he's in error.
Huh. Okay, Steve, say it again, please.
Bucci.
Steve Bucci, PhD, Heritage.org. Steve, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Do you want big government in your email box? Coming to a computer near you. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. I'm still trying to figure out why this piece of legislation, which is like, you know, to what extent can the government collaborate with giant corporations to snoop on you? Why all the Republicans are all enthusiastic about it and all the Democrats are concerned about it, and the president's threatening to veto it, because this is the Patriot Act on steroids. This is the Patriot Act come to the Internet. Jim in Raton, New Mexico. Hey, Jim, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Tom.
Yeah.
The man that you just had on from the Heritage Foundation, there was a conflict between the way you interpreted that bill and the way he interpreted that bill.
I noticed.
And to my way of thinking, it's a twist on Murphy's Law. If it can be interpreted that way, it will be interpreted that way.
Well, and this is my big concern about CISPA, and thank you, Jim. Excellent point. Is that it is so broad. CISPA is so broad, so overbroad, that it not only can be interpreted in a variety of ways right now, but when it becomes law, if it becomes law, it could be implemented in a variety of ways that could mean, again, you know, the government. I mean, these big government Republicans, you know, they want the government in your underwear. They want the government, you know, checking out your bodily fluids if you wanted to get unemployment, of course. They want the government making sure that that you've got three different kinds of ID if you want to vote. These big government Republicans are just they're making me crazy. I don't get it. Gene in Westcott, Wisconsin. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hi, it's June.
June, I'm sorry.
And I want to tell you first that I voted today.
Oh, good. In Wisconsin. Good.
In Wisconsin. And I wanted to pass on some information that I have heard on NPR, and it makes a lot of sense, and that is the reason the corporations are so behind this CISPA law is because there have been a lot of cyber attacks on them where they've had to notify customers, etc., and they don't want to pay for it. They want the government to pay for it.
That makes perfect sense. And they also don't want the liability that comes along with it. I think that that makes perfect sense. Joan, thank you very much. I think you got it. Kathy in Merrill, Wisconsin. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Oh, I was just listening to your show at the top of the hour, and I just wanted to say I was just so upset when I heard about this. Who is he, Peterson? I never heard of him, and I don't
Jesse Lee Peterson, the regular Fox News contributor, and when they say contributor, that means that's somebody that they actually pay to have come on the air, who has called explicitly for, well, clip 14, Jacob. This is just 19 seconds. I'll let you hear it, Kathy. This is
sure.
This is him in his church preaching.
One of the greatest mistakes that America made was to allow women the opportunity to vote. We should have never turned that over to women. Right now, 50% of the voting population are women. There are more women out there voting than men now because there are more women than men. And these women are voting in the wrong people.
Yeah, they're voting in the wrong people.
I just think that's kind of astounding. I mean, I get people are entitled to their opinions. It's a shame that somebody has to pervert so-called Christianity to spout that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what upsets me is that there's not just this current new war on women. It's the fact that this kind of speech is coming out, you know, from like Limbaugh and other commentators, and now that he's getting a spot on Fox News. And could you imagine if somebody like him or he was on there saying this kind of thing about African Americans or some other
sure.
minority? Like, if he was to say, could you imagine, you know, the problems are because we let black people vote.
Right.
You know, why is this tolerated? Just because he's saying something about women? I mean, to me, it's hate speech.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Very well said, Kathy. Thank you very much for the comment and for calling in. Dominic in Albany, New York. Hey, Dominic. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up,
John? Thank you. First, thanks for exposing some of this stuff. I have some friends that are, you know, staunch Republican. I myself, I'm a moderate. I'm one of those persons who I am a strong advocate for. You know, the amendment for personal arms and so on and so forth. But I one of the biggest things I point out to a lot of my friends is that lately, as of late, a lot of the parties, whether they be Democrat or Republican, are on the same side of a different side of the same coin. In this case, here's the Republicans talking about personal freedoms, yet they're supporting a program that is so god-awful bad and intrusive into our personal lives that it smacks of this big government, big brother stuff, and it needs to be exposed more.
Yeah, there are, for example, there are progressives who are running around with their hair on fire criticizing President Obama about the National Defense Authorization Act and various, you know, drone strikes in Pakistan and things. And I think those are justified criticisms. And yet, the President of the United States is saying, this bill is so bad, I will veto it. And it really gives the lie, first of all, to the idea that both parties are, you know, Tweedledee and Tweedledum. There is a huge difference here. And mm-hmm. and also it says that if this president will sign off on extrajudicial killings, which he has done, which I think is wrong, but, you know, C'est la vie. Apparently, right. You know, the Supreme Court doesn't agree with me either. If he's going to sign off on that, but he thinks that this is a bridge too far, this must be really bad.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my point, is the flip-flopping. But I am glad that he's going to veto this. This is a horrible bill.
Yeah, apparently. Dominic, thanks a lot for the call. Will CISPA become the law of the land? We shall see. But I'll tell you, there's some very big companies that are looking at, hey, we get a waiver of liability and we get big government contracts. We can become like Boeing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming back, your thoughts and comments and the good, the bad, and the very, very brand new vocabulary word ugly. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very lacusculously ugly. The good. The Pinole City Council, the Pinole, California City Council, adopted an ordinance this week banning the sale of firearms and ammunition from home businesses. Prior to the council's decision, there had been a huge debate in the city about Second Amendment rights. However, gun control activists flooded public hearings on the issue, which influenced the council members, which is how it's supposed to work. Across the country, cities and communities are plagued by needless gun violence that could be prevented if lawmakers stood up to guns rights organizations like the NRA and large gun sellers like Walmart. It's time the communities all across America follow in Pinole's footsteps. The bad. South Carolina, Indiana, and Colorado. According to a new report by the Center for Public Integrity, lawmakers in all three states have exempted ALEC, the corporate lobbyist front group, ALEC, from state lobbying registration and disclosure laws. That means in all three states, ALEC can spend millions of dollars pushing corporate-friendly pieces of legislation without ever having to reveal how much money they spent. ALEC is responsible for everything from voter suppression and anti-environment laws to the now infamous Shoot First laws. Bottom line, ALEC is destroying America, and legislators in Indiana, Colorado, and South Carolina are letting it happen with no questions asked in their states. And the very, very ugly House Majority Whip Kevin McCarthy. Yesterday, Republicans in the House pushed ahead bills that prevent any cuts in military spending, but cut over $260 billion from programs like food stamps, Medicaid, and other social services. Well, McCarthy was on Fox News last night when asked about the cuts to the programs. He said House Republicans are just trimming the fat. Actually, according to the Congressional Budget Office, they are pushing 1.8 million people off food stamps that will cost 280,000 children their school lunch subsidies, and 300,000 children are going to lose their health insurance. That's what the Republicans call trimming the fat. And by trimming that fat, Representative McCarthy and his Republican colleagues are endangering the lives of thousands of our nation's children. And that is very, very ugly. Boy, is that ugly. Jay in Waco, Texas. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hi. Tom, the main thing that I wanted to discuss, I saw the Steve Bucci interview that you just did, and I had about four things here that I thought might be interesting for the CISPA debates. In regards to the first one, I noticed the cyber espionage, and I would probably say you would want to look on the Ars Technica article in regards to Anonymous and Robert Mueller, where basically Anonymous hacked into a server through an okay by the FBI, where Robert Mueller basically stated that he's going to fight cybercrime, cyber war. Number two.
What's your point?
The main point here is that the FBI probably has a lot to do with the CISPA.
I'm sure the FBI would love CISPA. I mean, you know, these federal intelligence agencies, give me more power, you know, and bring big corporations into it and let us hold their hands. And gee, now that the Microsoft is going to make money off this, when I retire from the FBI, I can get a job there. I mean,
no judicial oversight. Right. But the big thing is, for the last 15 years, the FBI has already been able to do this through the Cyber Initiative and Resource Fusion Unit, which is a 501c6 nonprofit that allows a big sharing from telecoms, ISPs, pharmaceuticals, et cetera, et cetera. So there's already this legislation in power already. So the question is, what are they going to do with CISPA if it actually passes?
Right, right. That's pretty remarkable. Okay, thank you very much, Jay. I appreciate the insight and the thoughts on that. Karen in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Karen, thanks for listening to AM 950. What's up?
Well, hi, Tom. I just wanted to thank you for your promotion of local food. I teach a class. I'm a naturalist in Minneapolis and called Itching for Itchweed. And one way to get around the high cost of really good food, especially if you're not a very good gardener or don't like to garden, is to know your wild edible weeds.
Yeah.
And so many of them. Two I want to mention to your listeners are lamb's quarters and purslane.
Right. Lamb's quarter, also known as pigweed.
And lamb's quarters is from Europe. Full of nutrition, volunteers. It's in your yards, it's in your sidewalks, and it'll help people really pay attention on what we're actually spraying in our yards, because you shouldn't eat it if people are spraying. My yard is chemical-free, and so many people should be, and it's just a great way. They make wonderful salads, and it's a real way to supplement your income as well as your diet. And it's as local as it can be, because it's just right out your door.
Yeah, we need to bring back Yul Gibbons, although he's passed from the great beyond.
I think Yul is a little too much into the rugged eating. I think you can make really delicious food. That's what I teach, and it's great. And
well,
I also want to thank you for. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say lamb's quarter is also known as pigweed, and it is in the spinach family. It's as nutritious as spinach. I mean, it's incredibly healthy stuff. And
well, it's got all the B vitamins in it, and the other one is itchweed, or stinging nettles.
Yep.
We have a local nettle. I'm from the Midwest, and anybody listening from the Midwest knows that stinging nettles is just getting all over our prairies, so you can help the prairies out by getting rid of it and eating it, and it's got 15,000 units of vitamin A for every 100 grams of weight.
Yeah, it's really good stuff.
It's incredible.
You bundle it up and with a pair of gloves, and you dip it. You put it in a pot of boiling water, and just wait a couple of minutes, and it neutralizes all the stinging part, and then you can eat it.
Absolutely, you can do it dry. Also, the water becomes a very good tea. Mm. I'm just saying, we could take back the whole food thing if we started realizing that a lot of things that are volunteering in our yards are healthier for us than the stuff we're trying to grow. And I grow heirloom tomatoes and blueberries and all that stuff. And I just eat the weeds. I don't spray them or anything like that. And it would really, I think, revolutionize the whole food thing if people realized that we really can identify plants and eat them and not even be a farmer in order to, get some part of our nutrition from our plants.
Agreed.
And I also want to thank you for your second chapter on Threshold. I love your book on overpopulation. I hope you do a whole show on it. And I'm on the board of World Population Balance. I'd love to come on your show and talk about that really grim issue, but we really need to talk about it more.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you for putting it on.
Sean Taylor, our executive producer, is the person who books the show, and her contact information is on our website at tomhartman.com. So, let her know. Thank you very much
Thank
for the call,
so
and you're welcome. Susan in Morgan, Pennsylvania. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you again. It's me again. And I hope Louise is doing well. I watched Anderson Cooper, and he had a behaviorist on two different times.
Mm-hmm.
And she was telling about how you can tell when someone's being truthful or dishonest with you. And when Mr. Bucci from the Heritage Foundation was on, when he would speak, one of his tells that she taught was excessive blinking when you're lying.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look back at the tape, you'll see that every time he answered a question of yours where it was obvious he was lying, he blinked at least three times every time he talked.
Okay.
The rest of the time, he didn't do that.
I will have to leave that to my viewers to determine. I'm uncomfortable. I have no problem calling a guest a liar when I know that they're lying. but I he may actually believe this stuff. I don't know. But thank you for that, Susan, and thanks for the call. Steve in Vancouver. Hey, Steve, what's up? Thanks for listening to KPOJ.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hey, so this whole fight over CISPA reminds me a lot of the Patriot Act and what went on during that.
Yep.
And I was living in Nevada at the time, and we were working to get municipalities to stand up against the Patriot Act, to say they wouldn't go along with it. And the first place that went along with that passed an ordinance against the Patriot Act was in the very reddest part of the state, Elko, Nevada.
Yeah, this is my point. I don't understand why Republicans who are, historically have said that the place that they're staking their flag is individual liberties and small government, want CISPA, where the government is going to basically, you know, to the extent that you live your life on the web, the government's going to know everything.
Well, the way we got around that is, you know, we'd ask him, would you sign this petition against the Patriot Act? No, the Patriot Act protect us. Right. And he says, well, let me tell you three words. President Hillary Clinton. They would absolutely freak out, couldn't sign that thing fast enough and be calling their wives and their friends over. Hey, you got to sign this thing. We got to get rid of the Patriot Act.
Right, because what happens when a Democrat comes into office? They trusted George W. Bush, but do we really want to give all this power? And they really
don't trust a liberal with all this power. And once you make them realize it's not always going to be a conservative in charge,
yeah,
they change their tune really fast.
Yeah, very, very well said and a great strategy. Steve, thank you very much for the call on that. And thanks for the comment. Let me just share with you, we have just a couple seconds here before the break, very quickly. CISPAs, this is the summary the Think Progress put together. The broad language likely give the government access to anyone's personal information with few privacy protections. It supersedes all other provisions of the law protecting privacy. It completely exempts itself, the law does, from the Freedom of Information Act. It gives companies blanket immunity from future lawsuits. Citizens have to trust that companies like Facebook are not going to share your personal information. Good luck on that. And companies can already inform the government and each other about incoming security threats. They don't need the CISPA law. So what CISPA is the Patriot Act for the Internet. And what it does is it allows all the big Internet companies to become part of the military-industrial complex, which they're all chomping at the bit to do.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And which I think, frankly, is quite dangerous. Quite dangerous. Mitt Romney, by the way, putting his foot in his mouth or just lying? We'll share that with you in a minute.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy.
Now, Leonard talks about the ashes of the gay. We were talking yesterday, I believe it was, about the differences in ethnic groups disliking gay marriage. And thanks to Jessica, who sent me this information, this is from a Pew study. Pew is pretty reputable and pretty kind of in the middle. You know, they don't have a particular axe to grind. They just do good research. In April of 2012, so this is recent data, 48% of men nationwide, 39% of women oppose gay marriage. So the majority are fine with it, okay? The white-black difference is not that great. 43% of white men of whites oppose gay marriage. 49% of African Americans oppose gay marriage. So it's only a 6-point difference. And when you look at Hispanics, now this was a different set of questions that included, you know, a slightly different cohort, so the numbers changed a little bit for whites. But this is opposition to gay marriage. Whites were at 52%, blacks at 66%, Hispanics at 49%. So Hispanics were actually more tolerant of gay marriage than whites were. So anyhow, that's interesting. Whoever in the chat room was correcting me on this yesterday, thank you. I stand corrected again. Mitt Romney, back in 2008, published an op-ed in the New York Times the title of it was Let Detroit Go Bankrupt. He was trying to stake out his conservative credentials and say, let the private sector deal with this. And President Obama came along and said, the private sector is not providing money to anybody. They're not going to loan, you know, Chrysler and GM are going bankrupt. And they did go bankrupt. And if they wanted to continue operating during that bankruptcy, and if they wanted to come out of the bankruptcy, they needed billions of dollars in loans. And there weren't any banks who could give it to them. Now, under the Romney plan, they would have simply dissolved. They would have gone away. All those jobs would have gone away, and we'd buy nothing. You know, nowadays, all of our cars would be Nissans or Toyotas. I mean, there just wouldn't be any more American cars. And I get it. Chrysler's not an American company anymore either. But actually, you'd have Ford. Ford was the one that wasn't in trouble, and good on them for that. But GM would be gone. But now, and President Obama stepped in and said, okay, you know, government is going to provide the bridge loans, and government has been largely paid back, and it's worked out well, and people still have jobs, and it's like it's a good thing. So Romney, now that this is popular, having saved the auto industry, Romney is going to do it. You've heard me say this many times. The only way this guy can get elected president is to lie. And here's his lie for today. Clip number one, Jacob.
Well, my own view, by the way, was that the auto companies needed to go through bankruptcy before government help. And frankly, that's finally what the president did. He finally took them through bankruptcy. That was the right course I argued for from the very beginning. It was the UAW and the president that delayed the idea of bankruptcy. I pushed the idea of a managed bankruptcy. And finally, when that was done and help was given, the companies got back on their feet. So I'll take a lot of credit for the fact that that this industry's come back.
He's going to take a lot of credit for the industry that he wanted to see die. And you know what's most bizarre and tragic about this? He's probably going to get away with it. This is the big lie strategy. You know, tell a lie that's outrageous enough and big enough, and people will go, oh, yeah, okay, that could be. Similarly, student loans. You know, today the Senate voted, and the Republicans filibustered a Democratic bill that would have dropped kept at 3.6%, I think it is, the interest rate on federally backed student loans. It was a good thing. I mean, our kids are $1 trillion, and not just kids. There's adults who have these student loans as well, but people have $1 trillion. It's more. There's more student loan debt than there is credit card debt. So the Republicans filibustered this bill because it said, if you're making your money the way Mitt Romney does as capital gains and paying only 15% federal income tax, you're going to have to at least start paying some Social Security taxes. Really? We can't have that? A tax loophole going away? Oh, no. Instead, what the Republicans want to do is they want to slash money out of food stamps, children's health programs, and mammograms and preventative health programs for women. And when Paul Ryan was asked about this, clip number three, Jacob, here's what he had to say. I'll give you the punchline in advance so you'll know it when you hear it. He answered with one word, nope, N-O-P-E, listen.
Would you support closing corporate tax loopholes to pay for that as a revenue raiser?
Nope.
Would you support closing corporate loopholes to pay for that? Nope. Yeah, that's our Paul Ryan, your friendly local sociopathic Ayn Rand supporter. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, you know, remember last month they were criticizing the Republicans for being unchristian? Happened again today. Today, the bishops sent another letter to Congress slamming the Republicans' attempts to cut similar programs in a reconciliation program. Here's what they said. As Reverend Steve E. Blaine, chairman of the USCCB's, the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, Committee on Domestic Justice and Human Development. This is just another example of how the Catholic Church has so often been out at the forefront of social justice issues. They wrote, the proposed cuts to programs in the budget reconciliation fail this basic moral test. The Catechism of the Catholic Church states that it is the proper role of government to, quote, make accessible to each what is needed to lead a truly human life. Food, clothing, health, work, education, and culture, suitable information, the right to establish a family, and so on. Poor and vulnerable people do not have powerful lobbyists to advocate their interests, but they have the most compelling needs. Catholic bishops calling out the Republicans today. Coming up tomorrow, coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, if you work at home as a caregiver to an ailing parent or other relative, your home raising your children, shouldn't our social safety net be there for you? I'll challenge Carrie Lucas, the Independent Women's Forum, on that. Plus an update on the Machinist Union strike against Caterpillar. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.